Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Karepko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have landlocked Ethiopia's plans to build a navy. New President Abiy Ahmed was speaking with military leaders when he told them that we should build our naval force capacity in the future, which instantly attracted international attention because the country's been landlocked since Eritrea's 1993 secession. That now independent country has always feared that Ethiopia still harbors designs to either forcibly reincorporate it or turn it into a proxy state for regaining its historical access to the Red Sea, though that's unlikely what President Ahmed had in mind when he made his curious suggestion. Bloomberg included some very relevant information in their brief report on this development by reminding people of how Ethiopia has recently reached different port deals with Sudan, Djibouti, the self-proclaimed independent Somalian region of Somaliland, and Kenya, all across the Horn of Africa region, thus giving the country a natural interest in wanting to protect its terminal investments and the sea lines of communication that go along with them. Correspondingly, it can also be expected that Ethiopia would eventually clinch conventional military deals with its regional partners in order to protect the transport infrastructure connecting their ports with the landlocked giant, which is the second most populous country on the continent and also has one of the world's highest rates of economic growth. The development of an Ethiopian navy would also be the first time that an African country has proactively gotten involved in the new scramble for Africa that began in the Horn region in the mid-2000s, following the spree of Somali piracy off the coast. In the decades since, this part of the world has become one of the most militarized, with American, Chinese, Emirati, Saudi, Turkish, Italian, French, and Japanese bases popping up all along its coast. And Russia was just recently invited to build a naval base in Port Sudan late last year after President Bashir's visit to Moscow, though it's unclear whether President Putin plans to take him up on this offer. What Russia can do, however, is assist its Soviet-era Ethiopian partner with its plans to build a new navy, which could, in and of itself, herald an important return to Africa for Moscow and enable it to showcase a different dimension of its military diplomacy than the air and ground forces that gained global renown during the anti-terrorist intervention in Syria. The next one up is NATO declaring that it wouldn't assist Israel if it went to war with Iran. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg articulated the bloc's policy during an interview with the German publication Der Spiegel, explaining that Israel is not a member of the alliance and therefore ineligible to receive multilateral mutual defense commitments from it. This came as a shock for some people who had hitherto assumed that the organization would take Israel's side in any prospective conflict with Iran, prompting claims that this represents a defeat for unipolar interest and is bad news for Israel. In reality, however, that's not exactly the case, because the U.S. has always been the most important member of NATO and would surely side with Israel under that scenario. With the participation of militarily useless members such as Albania and Croatia not making any difference whatsoever in determining the course of what will come next. The UK and France, the two next most relevant forces in this bloc, notwithstanding Turkey, who obviously wouldn't get involved, could follow America's lead just like they did when they carried out joint bombings against Syria in April. Given the likelihood of an instantaneous pro-Israeli coalition of the willing forming within NATO, Stoltenberg's policy announcement begins to look less dramatic and comes off as a politically correct statement of technical fact that might have been designed to mildly signal passive aggression from some of the bloc's European members who are angry with the U.S. for unilaterally withdrawing from the Iran deal and threatening to escalate the so-called trade war. If push comes to shove, however, then the UK and France would probably join the US in, as they'd frame it, defending Israel. But even in the event that they don't, it won't make much of a difference anyhow, since all that's important is that Washington rushes to the aid of its top ally. Clumsily attempting to manage a multinational war effort at the spur of the moment, after an unexpected outbreak of hostilities, might even hold the US back from its full potential, with it being much more effective just going it alone with its massive military instead of wasting time trying to get insignificant countries to jump on board with it. Third on our countdown is Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's trip to the tiny Central African country of Rwanda and what it reveals about Moscow's new strategy towards the continent. The visit was an astounding success, with Lavrov discussing future military deals, including over air defense systems, nuclear energy prospects, and economic cooperation with his Rwandan counterpart. But there's more than meets the eye, because some crucial contacts need to be mentioned about what brought this unlikely pair of countries together in the first place. Russia has been supporting the nearby Central African Republic with arms and military trainers since the end of last year, as it struggles to liberate the 80% of its civil war-torn but mineral-rich territory that's still under the control of various militias. And it's likely in this capacity that Russian representatives came into contact with some of the nearly 1,000 Rwandan troops who formed the more than 14,000-strong UN peacekeeping component in the country. Tiny Rwanda punches well above its weight when it comes to military affairs, as it proved during the two Congo Wars, the first of which saw it conquer the gigantic neighboring country roughly 100 times larger than its own size, and then install an allied proxy as its leader. The Congo is once again nearing the brink of war, and it's possible that the slow-motion meltdown of the past 2 years will accelerate into another full-blown collapse, potentially drawing Rwanda back into another Congolese conflict. Kigali already stages occasional raids into the eastern Congo in order to hunt down Hutu militia leaders that it claims are terrorists and were involved in the 1994 genocide, and it's also reported to still be controlling Tutsi militia in the region as a means of indirectly countering them and maintaining influence there via the mineral trade that they're said to be involved in. Russia recognizes the reality that Rwanda is a military superpower in Central Africa, and that it would surely play a decisive role in any forthcoming Congo war, which might also be why Lavrov was so eager to visit the country and find out what President Kagame discussed with Macron at the end of last month during a closed-door meeting in Paris that media reports suggested was about the developing Congo crisis. Russia envisions its 21st century grand strategic role as being the supreme balancing force in Afro-Eurasia, and it's in this context it's worthwhile to mention that Moscow and Kinshasa recently revived their 1999 military agreement for Russia to provide the Congo with military training and equipment, so it makes sense why Moscow would have an interest in strengthening its ties with both Kinshasa and Kigali in order to mediate any potential problems between them. Remembering Russia's newfound role in the Central African Republic, it's plain to see that the country's pivot to Africa is aiming right at the continent's geostrategic heartland when one factors in its Rwandan and Congolese dimensions. Furthermore, Rwanda, as this year's chair of the African Union, is where the Continental Free Trade Agreement was signed a few months ago in creating the basis for an EU-like borderless trade area, so it's also fitting that Lavrov took the occasion during his trip there to announce that Russia and the African Union are drafting a cooperation agreement. They will presumably seek to formalize his country's interest with the bloc vis-a-vis its recent pivot to Central Africa. Ultimately, Moscow's forthcoming moves in Africa will depend to a large extent on what happens in the Congo and how skillfully it can leverage its latest relationships in the Central African region in order to advance a comprehensive continental policy and the new Cold War. Our runner-up is self-exiled Russian journalist Arkady Babchenko's false flag assassination in Kiev. Most people are already aware of his dramatic stunt in appearing at a live press conference about his reported killing and then admitting that the whole thing was staged in order to capture what he claimed were his Russian-backed wannabe assassins. But many have yet to realize the larger implications of what just happened. A lot of commentary has since been made about how irresponsible it was of Ukraine to carry out this false flag incident in tricking the world for the sake of smearing Russia's reputation right before the World Cup, with the revelation that this was 100% fake news being used to cast even more suspicion on the mainstream media, and especially those that are operating within Ukraine, than ever before. Relatedly, it reinforces claims that the White Helmets' famous videos of dead children in Syria were also faked, like how independent journalist Vanessa Beely proved through her extensive investigative reporting in the country over the years, to say nothing of renewing doubts over the official narrative about the Skripals. In hindsight, this self-admitted false flag provocation retroactively adds credence to the argument that these two aforementioned high-profile examples were also staged as well. Though there's also another angle to all of this that hasn't been given the attention that it deserves, and that's the cooperation between journalists and the deep state. By now, it's taken for granted that some journalists clandestinely cooperate and even coordinate their activities with their de facto handlers from the permanent military, intelligence, and diplomatic bureaucracies after witnessing how the media waged its info war against Trump over the past 3 years. But Babchenko's false flag assassination introduced a new dimension into all of this. Surprisingly, the US-funded Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty platform reported that the staged photo of his killing was, quote, first published on the Facebook page of a former Ukrainian reporter who says he now works for a shadowy consultancy organization based in the Washington, D.C. area, end quote. The only way that he could have received that was from a member of the Ukrainian deep state itself, which passed it along to their D.C. asset with the intent of laundering the picture through social media and making it organically go viral, representing yet another level of collaboration between the deep state and so-called journalists. Altogether, this false flag involved two separate but interconnected influence operations through willing journalist participants. The first and most obvious being Babchenko himself, who can be described more as an information provocateur and even a troll instead of a journalist. And the second DC-based individual who laundered the fake pic of Babchenko's assassination. At our top spot, we've got the U.S. military rechristening its Pacific Command to the Indo-Pacific Command, as it strongly signals its growing interest in India and its eponymous ocean. The importance of this development shouldn't be underestimated because it sets a strategic basis for the U.S.'s 21st century policy of containing China. The People's Republic depends just as much on the Indian Ocean as it does the Pacific because of the role that this body of water plays in facilitating commerce with Europe and Africa and the energy trade with the Mideast. Hence why it's pivotal for the U.S. to prioritize military operations in this ocean and its surrounding rimland. To that end, America has entered into a game-changing military strategic relationship with India through the 2016 Lamoa Logistics Agreement that allows both great powers to use one another's facilities as part of what former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson described late last year as their planned partnership for the entire 21st century. The U.S. envisions India becoming a bulwark against China and functioning as Washington's premier lead-from-behind partner in containing it, though it recognizes that it probably can't sustain this role for too long unless it receives multilateral support. Ergo, the so-called Quad, that also involves Japan and Australia, and could unofficially be called the Hex through Vietnam and France's participation as well. India's Lamoa-like deal with France to also use its Indian Ocean military facilities gives New Delhi the potential to massively expand its strategic reach in the region and fulfill its U.S.-backed geopolitical destiny, which just received a strong strategic boost last week after Prime Minister Modi clinched an agreement to develop a base in Indonesia's Sabang Island right near the mouth of the Strait of Malacca. A new American-encouraged great power constellation is therefore in the process of forming all across the Indo-Pacific rimland, in seeing India, Indonesia, and Japan deepening their multilateral strategic integration with one another, with Washington desiring for New Delhi to play the role of regional hegemon in the Indian Ocean, Tokyo to do so in the Pacific, and Jakarta to bridge the two together in the Southeast Asian archipelago, connecting both of their bodies of water together. Seeing as how over half of this grand strategy geographically involves the Indian Ocean, it's therefore appropriate that the erstwhile Pacific Command updated its name to the Indo-Pacific Command to better reflect the bulk of its future efforts. The next step that could be expected would be for the U.S. to organize a so-called Eighth Fleet in the Indian Ocean region in order to more effectively concentrate its strategic focus in this part of the world. The Japanese-based Seventh Fleet covers the same area of maritime operations as the Indo-Pacific Command does, which includes the half of the Indian Ocean, south and east, of its namesake country, so it would make sense to decentralize operations by setting up a separate regional branch that's actually based in this body of water. Although the Bahrain-based 5th Fleet would probably still remain responsible for activities around the Arabian Peninsula, the Italian-based 6th Fleet wouldn't have to take care of East Africa like it already does, because everything east of the Cape of Good Hope would prospectively fall under the 8th Fleet's area of responsibility. So, as to not be misunderstood, there presently aren't any serious plans to create an 8th Fleet, but it's illogical that this might eventually follow the rechristening of the Pacific Command as the Indo-Pacific Command, and naturally have an Indian Ocean base of operations either in Diego Garcia or somewhere on the South Asian mainland in order to more effectively contain China. All right, folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice weekend, and tune in again next week. Thanks. Bye.